Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As lawmakers in Washington continue to debate health care, we thought we'd look today at one of the off-the-radar health care reform proposals that might affect more people than even the public option proposal. I'm referring to wellness programs that a growing number of employers are offering to workers to incentivize them to stay healthy. Washington's now hammering out provisions that would allow employers to ratchet up the pressure on workers who choose to be part of company wellness programs, letting companies penalize workers a lot more for failing to meet benchmarks, for instance, for not managing their weight, smoking, or high cholesterol. And what's more, these penalties would also apply to people who buy individual health insurance. David Hilzenrath is a reporter for The Washington Post. He's been tracking the debate over wellness provisions. And David, just to remind ourselves, insurance has always been about spreading risk across as many people as possible to help the seriously ill. But there's a new debate about whether some people are being unfairly subsidized for health problems they can fix but don't. Tell us about this new philosophical debate.
Robin, you're right. It does raise some philosophical questions. Why should non-smokers subsidize smokers? Why should people who eat their vegetables subsidize people who eat their Big Macs? We've heard from readers who ask, where do you draw the line? How about skiing or drinking beer? And at a deeper level, Robin, should health insurance be like auto insurance, in which good drivers earn discounts and reckless ones pay a price, all to encourage safer driving? There is another approach, and that is, should health insurance be a safety net, in which the healthy subsidize the sick, with the understanding that any of us could get sick at any time?
Well, and that's what the thinking has traditionally been, that people who are younger and healthier pay for the insurance that they might not use. But the understanding, as you write, is that illness is transitory, and so you are going to have it later in life. You pay into the system early on. You help cover the older and those who are not well, and then someone helps cover you down the road. And this new thinking that maybe you get penalized or get discounts depending on your lifestyle choices, doesn't that run up against the Obama promise that people won't be punished when they go to get insurance if they have pre-existing conditions?
That's exactly right. The context for this debate is that President Obama and members of Congress have said that they're trying to create a system in which no one can be denied coverage or charged higher premiums based on their health status, and by that standard, wellness incentives could introduce a giant loophole.
Well, let's talk about how they work now. What can employers do right now when it comes to wellness programs?
Under current regulation, employers can use two types of wellness incentives. They can give employees incentives based on effort or participation, for example, for enrolling in smoking cessation classes, whether or not they kick the habit in the end. Companies can also give employees incentives based on results, quitting smoking, losing weight, meeting cholesterol targets. Under current regulation, there's no limit, Robin, on the size of incentives based on participation alone. But there are limits when people are rewarded for passing tests and penalized for flunking.
So you've explained two ways that employers can have wellness programs. They can reward people for participating in a Get Healthy program, or they can offer incentives for people who have achieved results. But this brings us to one of the criticisms of the overall thinking. There are people who can't, no matter what they do, can't change the results. There are, for instance, you know, diabetics, and I know diabetes supporters don't like this distinction, but there are some people who have diabetes because of lifestyle choices, and there are some who have genetic diabetes, and there's nothing they can do to reverse that.
Under the legislation, as under current law, employers would have to make exceptions. If somebody had a medical reason for being unable to meet the target, or if their medical condition would make it inadvisable for them to even try, the employer would have to make some alternative arrangement. But you point out the crux of this difficulty. It can be hard to determine what's in somebody's control and what's beyond their control. And I interviewed the CEO of a company that manages incentive programs, and he made an interesting distinction. He said, I can't give you an incentive based on being a diabetic or not being a diabetic, But whether you're managing your blood glucose level, I can give you an incentive based on that.
This is what diabetics have to do. They have to constantly test their blood and eat and exercise correctly to keep it at a certain level.
And the objective would be to get that person with diabetes on the proper medication, and they could pass the test if they had diabetes and were effectively managing their blood sugar level using insulin.
So you don't get penalized just for getting diabetes?
Theoretically not. If you had diabetes and weren't managing the condition properly, mm-hmm. and as a result, your blood sugar level was out of control.
This is this the Benecomp Group? They're based in Indiana?
That's right.
And this is a supplemental insurance company. And on their website, they say the wellness programs are voluntary. So do you even have to participate?
Well, the lawmakers who advocate this, and employers too, say these programs, these incentives would be voluntary. But one of the senators who has co-authored the proposal said that his plan would guarantee that the incentive is strong enough for Americans to want to participate.
Well, and the incentive is that you could, if you kept your blood pressure down, kept your cholesterol down, passed your medical tests with flying colors, you could conceivably really knock money off your premium.
Sure. Theoretically, people who pass these tests with flying colors could reduce their health care costs. That is, unless the reward is simply the absence of a penalty.
That's important, unless the reward is the absence of a penalty. In other words, in some cases, if you do well, nothing changes. But as you've just explained, some plans will penalize participants, say raise premiums if they don't meet goals. Other plans, as we just said, might raise the premium, and then participants can chip away at that high premium by meeting some goals. We've also been reading about the City Wellness Program in San Francisco. Now, theirs was a reward-based program. People paid, for instance, for not taking sick days. And now the city is realizing they're paying out way too much money. You say that's why the current thinking is to get away from rewards-only programs. They're too expensive. But what happens in a penalty program when people, you know, can't hit benchmarks and just can't afford their plan's wellness program?
First, unless they have a medical excuse, they could be out of luck. They could look for a plan that would take them as they are without penalty. Theoretically, such a plan would have a riskier population and higher expenses, making its premiums less affordable. Or they could become uninsured and pay a penalty for that. Remember, President Obama and members of Congress would require people to have insurance or pay a fine.
Well, it's not even clear that these penalty provisions are even going to make it into the final legislation. But you say some large employers are in favor of them. Why?
They're trying to cope with rapidly rising benefit costs. And they argue that encouraging healthy habits can improve the health of their workers and bring down insurance costs. They say it's not enough to control the cost of medical care. We need to reduce the need for it.
So it's like behavior modification.
Precisely.
And why is the American Heart Association against it?
Of course, this is a group that's devoted to combating heart disease. They aren't against encouraging healthy lifestyles. What they oppose is tying people's premiums to things like blood tests and weigh-ins. Critics fear that the employers could use these incentives to drive people out of their health plans or even out of their jobs. They say people could be penalized for things beyond their control and that health care could become less affordable for those who need it most.
Yeah, Dick Woodruff with the American Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network, told the New York Times, everybody needs insurance. This is a barrier. Unhealthier people either pay more or are priced out completely. But as you noted, others are saying, well, why should healthy people continue to subsidize unhealthy people? Does it work? Benton County, Arkansas has tried it. What were the results?
Benton County, Arkansas implemented one of these programs 4 years ago. And during the first 2 years, the county's share of employee medical costs declined sharply. Since then, they've soared. And it's hard to know what to conclude.
So asking people to screen for tests to see how they do means that you might find out they're sick.
And the hope is that they'll get treatment and that the money spent in the short term will save money on the long term because those people will avoid medical catastrophes.
Yeah. Another company that tried a wellness program is the auto parts maker Valeo. What they did was raise individual employee deductibles from $200 to $2,200 and family coverage deductibles from $400 to $4,400. Now, before you gasp, the way they designed this is that employees could immediately start bringing those deductibles down by getting credits for meeting health targets. So how is that going?
On average, as you said, workers had $200 deductibles before the program was introduced and $600 deductibles after factoring in their wellness credits. So for the average worker participating in the program, certain out-of-pocket expenses have tripled. And one of the ways these programs save employers money is by shifting costs from the company to the worker. From the company's standpoint, it can be heads I win, tails you lose. The company can save money whether or not the workers get healthier.
So we've given some examples. How widespread are wellness programs now?
Wellness programs have become increasingly popular in corporate America. And the most popular ones are the ones that reward participation or effort. The ones that actually base rewards or penalties on the achievement of medical targets, they seem to be the exception. And I've seen some survey results suggesting that next year, in 2010, 1 in 7 employers plan to reward people for achieving health status targets.
I'm thinking too, David, isn't this a lot of work for the insurance companies because they have to figure it out? You know, they have to sort of do detective work.
They can. They can outsource it to vendors who specialize in this. And there are other reasons why they would do that anyway, and chiefly to protect employee privacy. One of the big concerns about these programs is that employees don't necessarily want their employer knowing all of their medical details. And theoretically, there are legal protections that would prevent those outside vendors from sharing the information with the employer. Employers I've interviewed say they aren't privy to the information, they don't want the information. But groups like the American Heart Association are concerned that the legal protections may not be airtight.
I'm imagining that you could have a family, an entire family, struggling with diabetes. You know, what would that do potentially? How might that potentially raise a family's premium?
Well, again, if people have a valid medical reason for failing to pass these tests, the employer and the insurer would have to make some exception. But if you had a family that missed the targets, they could be looking at $6,700 a year in additional costs on average.
That's David Hilzenrath. He's a reporter for The Washington Post. He's been talking to us about wellness programs, how they operate now and how they might in the future in the new health care reform package. David, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, switching gears just ahead. Banks are slapping fees on credit cards ahead of new regulations. Also later today, a psychologist says keeping sex offenders in jail beyond their time isn't perfect, but it is stemming repeat offenders. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Well, it was speculated that they would do it, and now they're doing it. As predicted, some banks and credit card companies, scrambling ahead of new regulations next year, are either charging annual fees for some customers who pay off their cards every month and have excellent credit ratings, or charging customers who don't use their cards enough, or charging them for not using them at all. Sandra Block writes about personal finance for USA Today. She joins us. And Sandy, walk us through some of these new fees. Start with Bank of America. What are they doing?
They're going to start charging an annual fee. It could range from $39 to $99. And what has really gotten people upset is that it could affect some of their best customers, because in the credit card world, a good customer is sometimes the least profitable customer for the credit card. If you pay off your balance every month and you're never late, and you are basically not making a lot of money for the credit card company.
Right, you're not paying any late fees, so how are they going to get you? And this is how this is being seen by some consumer advocates, that this is a way to hit those good customers. What about Citigroup? What are they doing?
They are going to start charging a fee of an unspecified amount to customers who charge less than a certain amount every year, and the amount that's been batted around is about $2,400 a year. So if you spend less than $2,400 a year on your credit card, you might be hit with a fee, basically for just not spending enough.
And then other companies are also charging fees for inactive cards?
I would just guess this is something you're going to see a lot more of, because I don't know about you, but I have some credit cards that I never use. I just keep them for emergencies if another credit card were closed or I was a victim of identity theft.
Or there was that great sale at a clothing store,
right,
if you got the card that day.
Exactly. That is definitely not making any money for the credit card company. So I think some banks, one that's been mentioned I think was Fifth Third Bank, which is based in Ohio, are going to start charging inactivity fees. If you don't use your card over a certain period of time, they're going to charge you a fee.
What's the reasoning? I mean, is it as simple as it would seem that banks are looking for new revenue because of new restrictions that are coming that are going to, for instance, clamp down on raising interest rates?
Exactly. Starting next February, there are going to be a lot more restrictions on what banks can do in terms of interest rates, in terms of things charging you a higher rate, not because you were late on your credit card, because you were late on another bill, or raising interest rates on existing balances. Most of these things are going to affect people who carry balances, but because they are going to cut into banks' revenues, they're looking for ways to raise money across the board. And the other argument they're making is they would have to do this anyway because the credit crisis resulted in an increase in people defaulting on their credit cards. So they're losing money. Even without this legislation, they could be facing a loss of revenue, so they're looking for ways to make that back.
Well, what can credit card holders do? Because lay it out for us. You explain that sometimes you can't walk away from a credit card.
Well, this is where people get really annoyed, because any other business that you were unhappy with, you would just stop giving them business, right? If you didn't like your dry cleaners, you would go to another dry cleaners. Closing a credit card account is a little trickier because it could conceivably hurt your credit score. One of the things that is used in developing your credit score is the amount of credit you have versus the amount of credit you use. Now, if you close a credit card account, then available credit is going to shrink, and that could hurt your credit score.
It's a sort of a vicious cycle. With a hurt credit score, might it be hard to get another card?
Yes. Now, I don't want to overstate this. I think people who pay off their balances every month and carry very little credit are probably, it's not going to hurt your credit score that much. And if you're not planning to buy a home or a car anytime soon, maybe it's worth walking away anyway. But I think it's just something people need to be aware of.
Well, but you say before you walk away, literally call the card company if suddenly these new annual fees pop up, or you're being charged for not using your card or for an inactive card. You say call and demand that it be waived. Would that really work?
I've never tried this myself, but I've talked to people who have called and said, you know, I'm a good customer and I was charged an unfair fee, or I don't like this fee. I know of other credit cards that charge no fee, and if you don't waive this fee, I'm going to take my business somewhere else. Now, you may have to step it up a notch. You know, some of these poor folks who are working in customer service, who I imagine right now are having a very miserable days, getting a lot of angry calls, may not be in a position to do it. So you may have to say, can I speak to your supervisor? And I can't guarantee that this is going to work, but it's certainly worth a try. It doesn't cost you anything. And if you can get them to waive the fee, then you don't have to worry about what's going to happen to your credit score.
But you also remind us, before you walk or fight to waive the fee, find out what the credit card is worth to you. In other words, if you've got a big rewards program on it, it might be worth it to keep it, even, you know, if you have a $99 annual fee.
Yeah, and that's where people really have to get sharpen their pencils and get out their calculators. I think that's going to become a much bigger issue. Used to be, even now, there are some pretty generous rewards cards that have no fees. Everyone I talk to say that's going to go away. You're going to have to decide if the fee is worth the amount of the rewards that you get. And that really is going to require you to take a very hard look at your spending, how much you travel, what kind of rewards you get, all kinds of things, because I just don't think that they're going to be giving rewards away for free for much longer.
Sandy, while we have you, right now we know the new Consumer Financial Protection Board is looking at debit cards. And there's a move in Washington to make sure that banks let debit card users know that they're overdrawn. Right now, banks can let a debit card go through and then charge you an exorbitant rate if you're overdrawn. What's going on with overdraft fees?
Well, this is another way that banks are looking to raise revenue, and it's hugely controversial because it can get incredibly expensive. People are finding that just because they spent maybe a couple dollars over the amount in their checking account, that they're being hit with fees of $35 or more for every purchase that goes ahead of it. Banks say that this is a convenience they're offering customers because people don't want to go to the grocery store, give their debit card, and have the cashier tell them, I'm sorry, you can't buy any flour today because you've run out of money. So what I think regulators are looking at is requiring banks to tell people they're out of money. Another is to allow people to opt out of overdraft fees. And some credit unions and smaller banks are already doing this. It's just giving customers the choice when they open the account. Do you want to opt out of overdraft protection is what they're calling it.
That's Sandy Block, who writes about personal finance for USA Today. Sandy, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll see how two different communities, a Native American tribe in Idaho and a rural town in North Carolina, plan to use stimulus money to expand their access to the Internet. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, did you know the word bandana comes from Hindi? We'll explain how a Hindi word sailed from India to Salem, Massachusetts, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. Welcome back to Here and Now. To some troubling news out of Palo Alto, California, a town that's struggling to deal with four suicides over the last 5 months, three of them students at Gunn High School in the city, the fourth a middle school student getting ready to enter high school. And each of the suicides took place at the same train crossing in town. Lisa Krieger has been covering the story for the Mercury News. And Lisa, we want to say right at the outset that everyone in town is being very careful reporting and even talking about this. Your paper is not naming the young people.
We're not. There's a lot of concern that you may inadvertently encourage other suicides. The school is trying desperately hard to focus on mental health issues and identification of depression, getting kids to open up. At the same time, you know, as part of the education, they don't want to encourage further suicide. So there's a lot of sensitivity about reporting this. It's a wonderful community, wonderful high school, very high-achieving kids, a lot of them affiliated from families with the tech companies or Stanford University. It's a community that loves its kids and is alarmed about this,
right,
of course.
Well, and we are talking about the four suicides. There were attempts?
There was also an attempt. So what we have is a 17-year-old boy who died Monday night, another young person who died in August. There was an attempt in June. There was another suicide in early June, and then one in May, all at the exact same spot on the tracks. Kids didn't necessarily know each other, so it's not as though it was done collaboratively. What we're beginning to recognize is that this has become a hot spot. It's a magnet, and because kids are very suggestible and impulsive, and if you combine that with a place that's highly accessible and highly lethal, and your classmates have died there, if there's a triggering event in a just normal teenage depression, it becomes a very tragic and permanent solution to what's a real just temporary problem.
Well, the Golden Gate Bridge, for instance, became a destination for people attempting suicide. It was blocked off. Has there been an attempt to block off this train site?
There are efforts underway to figure out how to do that. It's tough because the train needs to get through. A lot of discussion looking at what's been done in Europe, where trains are much more plentiful, and this has been a longstanding problem. The reality is, if you look at the research, that if you block access to a suicide magnet, people don't necessarily move anywhere else. The research relating to the Golden Gate Bridge found that 58 people drove across the Bay Bridge, which is equally high and equally dangerous, to jump from their cars from the Golden Gate Bridge. And other studies have been done elsewhere where people simply don't move anywhere else. So the efforts now are to look at perhaps an overpass for the trains, better lighting, volunteer patrols, surveillance cameras, In Europe, they have these ear-splitting messages. It's simply almost impossible to stay on the tracks and hear them while you're there, and also impenetrable barriers.
Well, and this would not be the first, you know, so-called cluster suicide. But do school officials and parents, does the town have any idea why it's happening?
They don't. They're now doing a lot of interviews with family members to find out what, if anything, is shared by these students. The reality is that if the tracks are there and it's they're known to be lethal, that a young person can have a fixation if they're having a hard time, and they might feel drawn to it. And the physical barrier could help prevent that.
Well, as we said, you and others have decided not to report names, not to provide any more details about these children. But that's tough in this day and age because it's all over Facebook and all the social networking sites. Is the town thinking about how to address that?
Yeah, there's no way. The kids are so tech savvy and so connected, and it's a good point. The reality is, after at least the most recent suicide, the kids heard the train try and stop. They heard the ambulance. They heard about it before we did. They told us about it. In reporting suicides, the risk is not to describe it as a glamorous or romantic act, or even glorifying the young person, which is easy to do if you love someone and care about someone.
Lisa Krieger of the Mercury News in Palo Alto, California. Lisa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a little break. We'll be back in 30 seconds. You're listening to Here and Now. Most Americans know about Salem, Massachusetts, which is always a busy place, especially around Halloween. Salem was the setting of the Salem witch trials, the subject of Arthur Miller's The Crucible. It's the home of a statue of Samantha, the witch in the TV show Bewitched. Remember once when she'd do that little nose twitchy thing? But did you know that Salem was also home to the country's first millionaire? That in 1800, Salem had the highest per capita income of any American city. In fact, Nathaniel Hawthorne grew up there and ran the port for a while, and the port was the source of Salem's fortune. Yes, the Salem police cars have witchy logos today, but look closely at the city seal. It has a ship sailing into the East Indies. The city's motto is, "To the farthest port of the rich East." Salem's trade with the rich East flourished, making the young American city a bit of a Silicon Valley. Dr. Vinita Shastri is co-founder of the Meru Education Foundation. She's written about this chapter of Salem's history, particularly the city's trade with India. It's fascinating. The Salem-India story tells the stories of the young men who climbed on board ships for a round trip that took more than 200 days. And Dr. Shastri, these voyages became the lifeblood of the city. What did the ships bring back?
They brought a lot of textiles, different varieties of textiles, from cotton to silk to different woolens. They brought back a lot of spices and sugar and teas.
They brought back bandanas.
They brought back bandanas.
Is this the first that the U.S., I mean, now we think of cowboys wearing bandanas, but were they from India?
Yes. The bandana actually is, the word comes from a Hindi word, which means to tie. The word is bandhana. And it was originally from the tie and dye style of making fabrics. And it was then called piece cloth, which was cut in a particular size to make handkerchiefs, which was the size of a bandana today.
And we know about the lives of these sailors because they didn't text at that time. They kept journals and they wrote about their visits. What was it like for a kid from Salem to find himself in India?
Every sailor was given a logbook and asked to write about the shoreline and what they saw and how they would navigate the ships into a port entry. We know so much about this trade because these logbooks became journals that the sailors maintained, and they wrote about their experiences in India. It's really the first encounter of Americans with the East, that they write about the new fruits that they saw, for example, their discovery of the mango, the new native people there. You know, how did they deal and work with each other?
Give me an example.
So Charles Currier, who I mentioned in the book, he went there to make some money, and he actually lived and rented in a beautiful big home with 10 bedrooms. But he had lots of servants, but he could never understand why and how these servants worked, and they had all very specialized tasks. And he writes in his diaries and letters that he is a little bit concerned why they don't help with his dressing or with his eating and so on.
He wanted them to be more of a valet, but that was...
That was not the case.
That was not something they wanted to do.
Right.
The other thing that came through this trade, it had an impact on religion. You write about the Unitarian churches that emerged in Salem at this time. What is the Unitarian connection?
So as the Salem citizens became much more open-minded through the trade, new ideas through books coming from the East on these trade ships influenced them. In fact, sometimes the sailors would get custom requests, and one of them was to bring back the Sanskrit Bible. And so we have the Bhagavad Gita, which is a book from the East, coming on these ships, which in time influenced Emerson and Thoreau and, of course, a number of people in Salem, which led to the faith and religious influences expanding into the Unitarian Church.
Right, giving rise also to the Transcendentalist movement here in the U.S.
That's right.
Well, it's a wonderful circle here. Thoreau then influenced by India. And then the young Mahatma Gandhi was very influenced by Thoreau.
That's right. So this is very interesting how ideas travel and circle back. The Bhagavad Gita and, as you said, Thoreau, then Gandhi, and then Gandhi's influence on Martin Luther King, and so on.
Well, and there was another thing that this huge trade between Salem and India did to this, you know, growing America. Salem at this point was the sixth largest city in the U.S. It's so hard to think of now, our little Salem. And so it accounted for 5% of all custom duties collected by the U.S. in 1807. What did that money mean to the U.S.?
So the monies coming from the custom duties were actually a huge part of the public treasury and their earnings. The Salem citizens actually contributed to the formation of the United States Navy, and a number of them were so young that they could retire early from because having made so much money. And Nathaniel Silsby is a good example. He then went on to be the Massachusetts senator in D.C. From 1836 onwards. A number of others retired early and went into manufacturing. So a contribution of this trade was the emergence of the Industrial Revolution here.
So as you say, the fact that all of these Salem natives, as young boys, went off, were sailors, made their fortune, and then were freed to do other things in their later life.
That's right. And they moved, a large number of them moved to Boston, which, as we follow the trade, as Salem trade declines, Boston grows.
Well, that's part of the answer to what happened to Salem, because what happened was in part Boston.
Right. So Salem was not a natural port. It did not. It had a very shallow entryway, so it was not really naturally destined to be a trading leader. As trade and channels were improved in New York City and Boston, these cities took over the trade from Salem. Eventually, with the Industrial Revolution, Salem declines.
Well, thousands of people still pour into Salem every year as tourists to see the Witch Museum. They have a very, you know, big Halloween up in Salem. But they should perhaps, you know, forge a costume out of a bandana, you know, in honor of the city's other legacy.
Right. And I think that is a very interesting aspect that drew me to Salem, because one of the fascinating aspects of this trade was that apart from the riches that came to the United States, art came to U.S. too. A number of these sailors developed good and long-lasting relationships and friends in India, both in the city of Calcutta and Mumbai. And names like the Vardias and the Ghoshes, they gave them so many gifts, which are now part of the display at the Peabody Essex Museum. And another interesting aspect of the trade, if I may add, is there was very little to take to the East at that time from the United States. So a lot of the bulk of the money, bulk of the trading goods that were taken from the United States was hard currency. So you'll see in the book lots of examples of just silver dollars being taken to India.
That's Dr. Vinita Shastri. She's co-founder of the Meru Foundation and author of The Salem, India Story. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Okay, we have time for a quick check of the headlines. The Church of Scientology is calling a fraud verdict in France an inquisition of modern times, saying it will appeal. A court in Paris today convicted the church of pressuring members into paying large sums of money and using commercial harassment on recruits. But the French court didn't order the Church of Scientology in France to shut down. Also, cloudy weather has delayed a test launch of NASA's newest rocket until at least tomorrow. The Ares IX came within 2 minutes and 38 seconds of launching before Mother Nature got in the way. Back in a minute with how young Germans are remembering the fall of the wall with a high school musical, Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. We promised you a story about civil commitments for sex offenders, keeping them beyond their jail time, and we will have a look at that issue for you tomorrow. But we close today with a look ahead at the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. The date is November 9th. Everyone of a certain age remembers where they were watching on TV as Germans took sledgehammers to the wall. But now the students at the John F. Kennedy School in Berlin are working on memorializing that date with a high school musical. The students at the German-American School are in rehearsals for a bilingual production called Voices Through the Wall. The BBC's Alexa Dvorzin attended a recent rehearsal.
Okay, give me 1 second, and then we're going to get here. Come on and sit down here closer to us. You can get out your scripts and any music that you might have.
Dr. Chuck McDaniel teaches history, psychology, and drama at the John F. Kennedy School. Right now, he's wearing his director's hat.
What happens is the lights, of course, will go down. You will all come out onto the stage. There'll be some platforms that are raised, and you'll be in tableau, which means you'll all be in a pose that is your character, whatever that character might be.
Some of the characters are based on real people. For the script, McDaniel used material from interviews that students did for an oral history project. Then he had some serious fun. There's an uppity wife of a West German banker, a couple of tight-lipped East German border guards, and a sharp-leggy blonde who sings her way out of an awkward situation.
Ist nicht Farbenschmelz, noch Kerzenschimmer, von des Grau des Morgens längst verjagt.
Should I keep singing?
Lea Wiedenmann's character ends up seducing the hapless police informer who's spying on her.
Schau mal, mein Kleiner, meine weiße Fahne.
Look, my white flag of surrender, she says. Not to be outdone by the seductress is a ditzy American tourist whose ignorance is obvious as she admires the graffiti on the west side of the Berlin Wall.
What really amazes me is just how beautiful the thing is. It's like one enormous civic art project, something that really binds the community together, something you can look at with pride, and the talent, the inspiration, breathtaking. Now be honest, doesn't this one look like Elvis?
The checkpoints between East and West Berlin form the backdrop for a Cold War romance between two music teachers, an East German man and an American woman, who's being followed by a police informer the minute she crosses the border.
That's him over there. You can wave to him if you like.
You sure?
He's a new one, still in training. You can always spot the new ones. The old ones, too. They want you to know that they are there.
Doesn't that defeat the purpose of them spying on you?
On the contrary, they want you to know they're watching. That is why they wear those terrible suits, like a uniform, so you can recognize them.
I don't know if I could stand it, being watched all the time.
Well, you try not to focus on it, but it is always there in the back of your mind. It has to be. Say the wrong thing in front of the wrong people and you wind up in prison.
The story plays during the time where the wall is, and there are these dark...
The wall falls in the end.
The wall falls at the end, and there are these two star-crossed lovers, like in Romeo and Juliet. Then we have a punk, which is me, the best thing ever.
Was your hair already dyed that turquoise green color, or did you do it just for the part?
I think that's one of the reasons why I got the part, honestly.
How much have you studied about the history of divided Germany?
Well, last year, at least in my grade, we did almost whole year, and my German class were doing a little more about the wall and the literature around it.
Like, some of the parents grew up in East or West Berlin, so they tell you about their childhood and everything. Like, my mom grew up in West Berlin, so she told me everything about that, and then the falling of the wall when she was there and everything, so.
What's even better for me is that I had the entire story about the wall fall and everything, and also the two wars, world wars, and then this year I'm doing it again, and the teacher said it's from the American side.
Are you American?
No, I'm German.
That's Carrie Rogers, playing a punk in West Berlin's subculture. She rants about the rigidity of German society when she's thrown out of art school for being a nonconformist.
Denn ihr Verstand ist so klein, so beschränkt, wie als hätte man ihre Gehirne in kleine Dosen gequetscht, als würden sie nie rauslassen.
They're so uptight, it's like their minds are crammed into little cans. There's no room to breathe, she says. They mold and manipulate you from the cradle to the grave. They say we live free here, but East or West, it's all the same. At least in the East, they're upfront about all their surveillance. Here, they talk about freedom, but they oppress you at every turn.
And then you sing...
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
So does the script make historical sense to these students who never lived in a divided Germany?
Definitely, yeah. I think it's also easier for all of us to relate to this because we grew up in kind of a bilingual environment, so I think it's really neat that especially this play is in German and in English, which creates a really special atmosphere.
In school, we learn a lot about this, especially since we're in Berlin. We're surrounded by this almost every day, so I think all of us can make sense of the script.
But communist East Germany, the GDR, isn't part of the curriculum for these students visiting from Fürstenwalde, less than an hour's train ride east of Berlin.
I never had GDR in our history lesson.
Really? How old are you?
18.
But it's not. No history of East Germany?
Not in our history lessons. It's not part of our plan.
Yeah, I think the same. That's the problem. So we don't have the thing in our history hour.
You grew up in what used to be the GDR.
Yeah.
And you haven't learned anything about the history of it?
Not really.
I think it's a political hot potato. The wall may be down, but there are still divisions and raw spots and inequalities.
Studies confirm the topic is still too hot to handle for many teachers in the East, but not at the JFK school, says Chuck McDaniel. Considering the Americans' post-war occupation of West Berlin with the French and British allies, the subject is inevitable.
We don't avoid it in our school, in part, I think, because of our mission, which is we're a bilingual, bicultural German-American school. And Kennedy standing at the wall saying, "Ich bin ein Berliner," there's no way we can avoid dealing with these issues.
20 years after the demise of what the East German authorities called the anti-fascist barrier, Voices Through the Wall offers a cheeky yet sentimental portrait of a scarred city. Without overlooking harsh realities, such as the shoot-to-kill policy for anyone who tried to escape to the West, McDaniel's script departs from the Cold War dogma he was taught in the United States.
What I'd learned about were cliches. It was us against them, the godless commies, what a crappy system they had. That was the kind of mentality we were raised on. When you got here, you realized it was not nearly so black and white.
How important is it that kids growing up today know about what came before the wall?
It's important, but history that you experience is always more indelibly etched into your mind than stuff that you were taught. Students who are growing up in a world where there is no wall, where there are no two superpowers, when this division doesn't work, it is no longer there, it's natural for them to not have these things fixed in their minds. That doesn't mean we shouldn't teach them about it. It's a gift to the younger generation that they don't grow up in a divided Germany. And they need to know the lessons of the division, but I don't think they have to feel them because they weren't a part of that. And it's not their guilt.
It's an exciting time to be a teacher.
Absolutely.
That's teacher Chuck McDaniel, also director of Voices Through the Wall at the John F. Kennedy School in Berlin. His musical premieres the week of November 9th, the 20th anniversary of the fall of the wall. Our report was produced by the BBC's Alexa Dvorzin. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.